The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This summit is not going to achieve denuclearization. I mean, just think of the Iran deal. It took us several years to get to an interim agreement, and then it took us another 3 years to negotiate the JCPOA, and it's an inch and a half or 2 inches thick. So the idea that the summit is going to magically generate a detailed roadmap by which the North Koreans are going to denuclearize is a fantasy. I mean, that's not going to happen. We're not going to get denuclearization on day two. And Mike Pompeo has already signaled very clearly that he understands that, which is that this is going to be the initiation of a sustained, complicated, painful process of negotiation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 5th, 2018. It was only a few months ago that President Donald Trump was threatening to rain fire and fury on North Korea, and Kim Jong-un's missiles were bombing the ocean on a regular basis. So it would be hard to blame anyone for wondering how we've made it so quickly to public talk about commitments to denuclearize and demilitarize the Korean Peninsula in advance of a Trump-Kim summit in the near future. To make sense of it all, I spoke on Friday to North Korea experts Mira Rapp Hooper, senior research scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, and Steph Haggart, distinguished professor at UC San Diego. We talked about how we got here, about what would make the Trump-Kim summit successful, and about predictions for the future of Northeast Asian security. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 307. We passed 300, people. That's kind of cool. Mira Rapp Hooper and Steph Haggart preview the North Korea summit. So it was only a few months ago that the president is talking about fire and fury and the size of the button on his desk, and we are all concerned about imminent nuclear exchange. And now we are talking about the end of the Korean War, denuclearization of the peninsula, and big summit meetings and warm exchanges of good feeling at Panmunjom. Steph, get us started. How the hell did we get from one to the other?
Well, first of all, it's head spinning, right? There's no question about that. I think the key event is actually the Kim Jong-un New Year's speech, which is a response to the pending Olympics. And he basically says that he's willing, in a kind of blackmail way, to participate in the Olympics. He says something like, well, we can't guarantee the safety of the Olympics unless we participate. And, of course, Moon Jae-in was an engager from the start. You recall he was a senior staff member under Nomu-hyun. And he basically picked it up and said, okay, let's make the Olympics work. And that Olympic diplomacy in turn set the stage for the rapprochement, both with the United States saying they're willing to talk. Mike Pence first dropped that coming back from the Olympics, which was a huge surprise. And then you had the summit with Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping, which was a prior step to the summit North-South, which then set the stage for the summit pending with the United States.
Mira, what do you think? What's What's the trajectory between one and the other? Is there more to it than that?
No, I agree with Steph's analysis entirely. I would just note, to put a fine point on it, that some of what is so fascinating in this whole picture, and I know we'll dig into it more, is the fact that it's largely been other actors, not the United States, that have been driving this train. So obviously the war of words, fire and fury, Trump's speech at the UN General Assembly, the feeling that we were really on a potential march to war in the Korean Peninsula, like, and this was really real, right? We were seeing very credible reporting, that options were being developed, you know, strikes were being gamed. Like this was a serious consideration. That what got us away from that point and to the place we are now, is largely of the initiative of Kim Jong-un, as Steph signaled, the sort of blackmail headed into the Olympics, and then a positive response by President Moon of South Korea, who carried forward, essentially creating a diplomatic opening that Kim has subsequently responded to in various iterations, then opening up the possibility to the United States and to Trump to join them. But the point is here that this is largely a set of diplomatic openings that have been created by other actors.
Okay, so if I am Donald Trump, I am feeling pretty good about myself right now, as he clearly is. And the three of us can sit here all day and say it's other actors. But if you're the guy who wrote The Art of the Deal and you imagine yourself a master negotiator and you've had many administrations precede you characterized by failures of this relationship, and you spend first few months in office thumping your chest and everybody tells you you're being irresponsible, and then all of a sudden the events that you guys describe pan out and now we're talking about the end of the Korean War, you're going to feel like this is you. And so my question is, how much does he get to take credit for this, and how much of that is egotistical fantasy?
Well, I think he has to take some credit for it. I think it's a win. And those of us who don't particularly care for his presidency, including with respect to the way he's treated our Northeast Asian allies, it's hard to say that, but it really is true. And here's where I think it's true. I don't think it's the statements about strikes. I think it's actually something that happened with the Chinese coming out of Mar-a-Lago, which is that there had already been a turn in Beijing of viewing the North Koreans as a strategic liability. And this is partly a longer-run process where the whole nuclear issue had created problems for the Chinese on the Korean Peninsula. But I think it's also Xi Jinping who decided that enough was enough. And the manifestation of that is really at the UN Security Council, where you got resolutions over the course of 2017 in particular that were really fundamentally different than what had gone before, because they went after North Korean commercial trade. So it wasn't just trade that could be tied to the weapons of mass destruction program. They started banning things like coal. And you just see a very sharp fall off in North Korean exports over the course of 2017. So everyone treats Kim Jong-un as a genius, but in a way, I think he's playing an extremely weak hand. He knows how much he has in the bank. And I think there's no plausible explanation that I can see for him coming back to the table other than the fact that he's constrained.
Mira, what do you think? To what extent does Trump legitimately get to claim credit for any of this?
Well, it's obviously a very difficult question to answer, right? Because by virtue of the fact that there are multiple actors that have created the opening, it's a multi-causal picture here. You take any one variable away and the picture looks very different. But it's worth stepping back and just asking ourselves, what is the theory of the case by which Trump gets credit for this, right? So if we give Trump credit, as Steph was just suggesting, it's because, number one, this administration has put in place much tougher sanctions than any administration has before. And they are really, you know, much more comprehensive. And I think there's no question that that is true. Then you add to that the president's own personal proclivities and sort of unbelievable use of threats of force in the late summer and early fall, which I think many would argue created a really credible prospect of conflict that may have had an effect on both the North Koreans and the Chinese. And so there is a credible case to be made that the coercion side under Trump has been stronger than ever before, and that has produced this opening. On the other hand, I do think that Trump himself as a person presents some real opportunity for Kim. So while he may be playing a weak hand in terms of the North Korean economy, as Steph suggests, he doesn't have to be a genius to realize that this is an opportunity for him to at least make a play at things that would have been previously inconceivable under any other US president. What I mean by that is the fact that he has a president in Trump, who he knows very well, harbors severe antipathy towards American allies, including South Korea, a president who at the height of his fire and fury statements was also threatening to end the free trade deal with South Korea, calling on South Korea to pay for the ballistic missile defense system that the United States and South Korea had deployed there. So engaging in this sort of mafioso shakedown of a critical ally at a crucial time. And Trump has made public statements before indicating that he might like to withdraw American troops from South Korea, particularly if the South Koreans don't give him what he wants on trade. And we see reporting just in the last day that the president has actually asked the Pentagon to draw plans to consider reducing U.S. forces in South Korea. This is sort of Kim Jong-un's dream world, right? It is a world in which the U.S.-ROK alliance is significantly eroded, in which the American troop presence on the peninsula is significantly reduced. That is by no means definitely what we're going to get out of some kind of deal coming up soon, but it would have been so much harder to envision under any other president. And in fact, Kim Jong-un's ideal world has a lot of crossover with Trump's own instincts. So while I think there is a positive picture you can spin when it comes to the way that the Trump administration has applied coercive leverage, there are also significant vulnerabilities that lie in the president's proclivities as a person, as an individual.
Mira, I recall the last time we chatted, you expressed the concern that Trump was giving away the store to China on security issues in Asia in prospective exchange for leverage on North Korea that you actually didn't expect to materialize. And we turned the other way. We sort of stopped doing phone ops operations in the South China Sea. We kind of give China a free hand in other areas. How much does that concern still bother you? When you look at the broad trade that we've gotten from China, does the trade-offs look worth it, or do you still worry that we've given too much to get too little on North Korea?
Yeah, the sort of central focus of my concern at that time, I would say, is still largely intact, which is to say that the Trump administration's Asia policy has been hyper-focused on essentially two issues. One is trade in the region with China, but also with South Korea. But the second is North Korea. And that in its hyper-focus on these two central issues, it's essentially mortgaged its ability to conduct a broader Asia policy that's motivated by long-term strategy that really engages China sort of across the board and throughout the region. My position personally is that that's still the case. We still don't see the trappings of a broader Asia strategy that really take into consideration the nature of the relationship with China as this administration supposedly sees it. The way that it depicted its relationship with China in the national security strategy was of a great power competition. And we certainly don't see the trappings of a strategy to match the NSS playing out in Asia now. We still see this hyper-focus on North Korea and on trade. That said, I think there's very little question that, as Steph indicated, the president has gotten quite a bit more out of the Chinese than any other president before him on economic measures, on cooperation with sanctions. A big question to my mind is how much of that is going to hold after this summit takes place. And I do believe it will take place. And I'd be interested for Steph's views on this question. But after Kim Jong-un paid his visit to Beijing several weeks ago, we already heard noise out of Beijing that they were willing to start letting up some of the economic pressure on North Korea, essentially in exchange for good behavior. So if Kim is brought in from the cold even slightly, does that knock this whole pressure coalition off course? Does that allow the Chinese to start on a de facto basis relaxing sanctions against North Korea? Because if that's true, it probably won't have been worth mortgaging an entire Asia policy in the interest of getting the Chinese on board on the North Korea issue.
All right. So all of this brings us to this dramatic meeting and declaration between the North and South. This provokes a real flurry of optimism. And I guess my first question, Steph, is how much of this is optics and how much of it is genuine grounds for optimism that a worthwhile deal is possible? And how do you read the declaration between the two Koreas?
I think the way to answer that question is to ask how the declaration and the subsequent meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump are linked or not linked. Because clearly, if you view the declaration as a set of aspirations that everyone has for North-South relations in the context of a broader nuclear deal, and let's remember one thing, the deal has not been done yet. So we're talking about Trump as if he succeeded. All he's managed to do is get a summit, the content of which we have no idea what it's going to look like. And so until we see what that actually looks like, it's hard to interpret the full meaning of the Panmunjom Declaration. And I think this really comes down to an issue of sequencing in the end. Because what the U.S. position has been, I think rightly, is we're willing to do a lot in principle, and the South Koreans are willing to do a lot, and sanctions can be relieved in the context of a credible path towards denuclearization. And so what I think Mira is referring to is that if these things get delinked in such a way that the sanctions regime is starting to erode, the good feelings of Panmunjom are there, the North-South relationship starts to develop in some way, but the nuclear issue gets caught in a long, slow-moving process of incremental concessions that don't seem to go anywhere and that permit the North Koreans to back out of their nuclear commitments, then this will be seen as a big fail, not a big success.
Do you think that the summit is going to happen? And to the extent that it does happen, is that a presumptive gift that the United States gives to Kim Jong-un in the form of legitimacy, or is that a presumptive policy victory for Trump?
Well, first of all, unless there's some information that it hasn't been revealed yet, and that's quite possible, there's no reason to believe the summit won't happen. I mean, Mike Pompeo's comments the other day suggested that this was something that was serious. This was not a joke. They're going forward. There was planning prior, well prior to him moving to state, because the intelligence community had been involved in that. So I'm operating under the assumption it's going to happen.
And is that a good thing from your point of view, or a bad thing, or a neutral thing?
I'm a supporter of the summit. I think we should be more relaxed because we don't know that much about what the North Koreans think. Everyone thinks they know what the North Koreans think. That's the feature of the North Korea Watchers community. He means this. He means that. He's going to screw us over. He's not going to screw us over. He's going to give them up. He isn't going to give them up. We don't know. And negotiation is basically a process of information revelation. We're going to see what he's willing to do and what cards he brings to the table. On whether this gives Kim Jong-un an internal bump, I just don't think we should make policy around that question. Of course it will. And of course he's going to be on the front page of Rodong Sinmun shaking the president's hand like he does with the Chinese and he does with Moon Jae-in. But my basic position is if this falls apart, we're back to where we were. We're not back to some place that's worse than where we were. And we had to do containment, and we had to do deterrence, and we were capable of doing that. And I don't see how we're any worse off from taking the chance on this.
What do you think, Mira? Is a summit a good idea with very limited downside potential? Or are the John Boltons of the world, at least the ones who are not now in government, who, you know, are concerned about giving Kim the gift of legitimacy and of a high-profile meeting with the president without accompanying concessions? Are they on to something?
Yeah, I am slightly more concerned about the summit itself. I'm very much in favor of talks. I'm very much in favor of diplomacy. And now that this is happening, I think there's no question that we should roll with it. I'm in agreement with Steph that this is, there's no indication that this is not happening. We should expect this to happen. My preference would have been for talks to start at a lower level, more consistent with what we've seen in the past from U.S. diplomacy, to understand just the art of the possible and the range of the bargaining space that may be open. I'm in agreement that we don't know exactly what Kim Jong-un may be willing to offer up and in exchange for what, but I would have preferred to see that happen at a level lower than the presidential level, largely, again, because of what we know about this president. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have described a president thus far in our conversation who is very much looking for a win, who wants to make the most out of the summit, who wants to be able to present a historic victory that none of his predecessors have been able to secure. But we also know that he has some proclivities that could be quite dangerous when it comes to the broader strategic scenario, a willingness to sell out allies or remove troops, and even more than that, that he's quite mercurial, and that when he feels slighted, there's some chance that he may tack back in a much more destructive direction, i.e. return to serious consideration of the use of preventive force on the Korean Peninsula, now with John Bolton as his national security advisor, someone who has actively written and spoken about preventive war on the Korean Peninsula regime change as a good idea. And the reason why I see that as slightly worse than the situation that we were in the fall time period, when we were also at risk that the Trump administration would consider the use of force, is that there is nowhere to go after you have had a failed presidential summit. So if we had had talks at lower levels and they hadn't panned out, or they had panned out, you would have the ability to continue to sequence things in a more incremental way. If Trump, and I don't think this is the most likely case, but if Trump decides that either the summit itself has gone bad, or more likely that the relationship with North Korea is not what he thought it was going to be in the months following the summit, there's not a lot of diplomatic cushion once the summit is the way that you have pursued diplomacy.
All right. So what looks like success from, so I'm trying to piece together what the success picture looks like here. And from Steph, I take that there has to be a deep linkage between improved North-South relations and denuclearization, that we can't separate those two questions. Mira, from you, I take that the real risk here is that we get a sort of over-enthusiastic reach for a deal that looks a little bit like 1993 once we get a few years out. And so my question is, if and when an agreement materializes, what are the metrics that we can hold it to in the short term to say, hey, this is a good outcome, this is a outcome with some question marks, and this is a really bad outcome, irrespective of the way the president might be talking about it. Steph, what do you think?
Well, look, obviously the summit is not going to achieve denuclearization. I mean, just think of the Iran deal. It took us several years to get to an interim agreement, and then it took us another 3 years to negotiate the JCPOA, and it's an inch and a half or 2 inches thick. So the idea that the summit is going to magically generate a detailed roadmap by which the North Koreans are going to denuclearize is a fantasy. I mean, that's not going to happen.
No, but we're going to have to make an evaluation. Is the outcome of this summit positive or negative? Is whatever is agreed to there, if anything, a step forward, a step sideways, or a step backwards?
given the opacity of the regime, given the propensity to cheat on every deal, given the propensity of both sides to say one thing one day and the opposite the next day, I don't even know how to evaluate the sort of top line, is this a win or is this a loss question?
No, absolutely. But nonetheless, I start by stating the obvious because it's important to understand that what Trump has said with respect to what the summit might achieve is fanciful. We're not going to get denuclearization on day two. And Mike Pompeo has already signaled very clearly that he understands that very clearly, which is that this is going to be the initiation of a sustained, complicated, painful process of negotiation. So the top line success to me would be something like, and deja vu all over again, the 2005 joint statement of the six-party talks, which basically said, here's the deal. Here's what we're talking about. We're talking about complete denuclearization on one hand, and Kim Jong-un mouths those words, and we're talking about a set of phased or large-scale Big Bang concessions on the part of the United States and the other parties that would include, inter alia, lifting concessions, reaching a replacement for the armistice, engaging in the reconstruction of North Korea, supporting a new policy direction on its part, with some timeline attached to that, so that this doesn't drag out infinitely. And I would prefer a fairly ambitious agenda, which moved relatively quickly, rather than something that is phased and drawn out over a long period of time. And I think the United States and its partners actually are in a pretty good position to demand that, because of what I said earlier about what I think the sanctions regime is doing. So what would be a loss for me is something that just looks infinitely long-lived, where you're trading small incremental things for small incremental things, rather than really saying, within a year, we're going to move towards, you know, some very significant actions on the part of all the parties, not just the North Koreans.
Mira, what does a win set look like, and what does a loss set look like for you?
A bad deal would be a deal that is basically a barbell of fairly superficial nuclear and missile-related concessions by Kim, coupled with an ill-defined promise to denuclearize at an indefinite future. So when I say ill-defined, or rather sort of superficial concessions, I point to the fact that he has already signaled that he may be willing to stop testing ICBMs, right? I think there's a really good chance that we could come out of the summit with a promise by Kim to stop testing and advancing the ICBM program, which would count as a win if you are Trump and, you know, if you are the United States. But if that is all that he conceded to that was material, would actually have the unintended consequence of decoupling the United States from its allies. Essentially, we accept a concession that is good for us, limiting the ICBM program before it's come to full fruition, and Kim has a reliable, deliverable ICBM, but we get almost nothing that is of material consequence to our allies. As I said before, coupled with an indefinite promise to denuclearize, so as Steph is saying, something that could drag out for years and that does not have a clean roadmap attached to it. So that's what a bad deal looks like to me, decoupling plus no clear way to get to the ultimate goal. A good deal looks like something that, number one, from a process perspective, tells us how we're going to get from this very showy presidential summit into real, rigorous, sustained negotiations. So it gives us a clear sense of what the diplomatic pathway looks like. And number two, starts to signal and put in place the steps for what arms control far short of denuclearization will look like. So I'm of the mind, perhaps more skeptical than Steph, that we are not going to see denuclearization from North Korea under this leader at all, full stop. But that we can get a lot along the way by trying interim things, namely by trying to get real arms control measures in place that might return international inspectors to the country, and by placing meaningful limits on the nuclear and missile programs and putting in place counterproliferation mechanisms. So seeing some tangible evidence that arms control was really going to be implemented in the next several months on this way to a goal that I don't believe will ultimately pan out with respect to North Korea would look like a good deal to me.
From Mira's point that getting from the high level showy presidential summit level to the level of detail that actually you would require to have a useful agreement, what are the nitty-gritty issues that actually would need to be resolved? One of them, to me, obviously, is transparency. Like, how do you know what's a verification system? But what are the baskets of issues that you'd need to figure out in order to even know if you had a good deal?
Yeah, I think that's the really important question, and that's where all the details, you know, come into play. So first of all, you've got to shut down the capacity of the North Koreans to generate fissile material. That's step one. And so Yongbyon is going to have to be shut down. It's going to have to ultimately be dismantled, or the capacity to extract plutonium from spent fuel rods, and the centrifuge program is going to have to be declared, and ultimately that's going to have to be wound down. Whether it's destroyed or whether it's mothballed along the Iranian lines, you know, those are the type of things that will come up in the next step. I think the hard things are going to be getting credible declarations on the stockpile of fissile material and of the actual weapons themselves. Now, we're not at quite as much a disadvantage on this as you might think, because we've got at least some capacity to estimate how much plutonium has been extracted and what the likely stock of nuclear weapons are. And obviously, if the North Koreans come in and say, well, that's off the table, we're going to shut down Yongbyon, but we're going to keep 25 nuclear weapons, then you haven't gotten there. So this is going to be much more complicated than the Iranian program. And that's just the nuclear piece. Then we've got the missile side. And there you're going to have to enter into negotiations, probably based on ranges. And I don't think the North Koreans are going to give up all of their missile program. And Mira's fear is that we would trade some concessions on the long-range missiles for something that's more intermediate run. And that's something I'm very concerned about. But a good deal would involve some caps on both, and even put things like conventional weapon systems and the deployment of forces in the north on the table. And then you've got the process-related issues, which you cited. That is, you've got to get the IAEA back on the ground, or some inspectors on the ground. They could be from the parties. In 2008, you had Russians and Americans in Yongbyon. But I think the IAEA is probably the right way to go on that. But I'm reiterating this partly to say that this is going to be a long process. And what you want to see in the front end is some commitment to the fact that that set of issues would ultimately be addressed. If it's not, then I agree with Mira. We're nowhere.
I want to throw in an additional variable, which is the nature of the regime in question. So obviously that's not a subject of negotiation. But I do look at this regime and I say the essential quality of this regime in its international relations is extortion. And extortion requires threats that are fundamentally military in character. And if you ask them to give up their major threats, they lose the ability or lose some of the ability to engage in the essential quality of their foreign policy, and which is an existential problem for them. And so I guess this is a question for both of you, but start with Mira. Why shouldn't I look at this as a credible deal is presumptively one that the North Koreans cannot agree to, and therefore we should assume that any agreement they can agree to is one that is, for some reason or other, not really credible, because the thing they cannot give up is the truly extortionate quality of the nature of who they are.
Right. So the theory of the case by which the North Koreans would actually agree to fully denuclearize along some reasonable timeline, as Steph has suggested, is essentially that Kim Jong-un is changing tacks, that he believes that with essentially complete nuclear deterrent, he is now able to come to the negotiating table more as an equal and begin to completely readjust North Korea's strategy in a way that prioritizes economic growth and de-emphasizes the type of extortion that you're talking about. So to believe that he has an interest in the full denuclearization package is to believe that he has shifted strategies entirely. This is why I remain quite skeptical that he is going to denuclearize entirely, because as you suggest, it does seem quite essential to the character, at least of the regime throughout the history we've experienced, that extortion and coercion are part of the package. That said, I do think that it is possible that we could get to some kind of interim arrangement where North Korea has not completely relinquished its ability to coerce and extort, and the region is still safer and more secure than it is today. Which is to say that we could enter into talks with some amount of credulity that progress may be possible, even if full denuclearization seems very unlikely, and end up in an arms control situation where caps have been placed on the number of weapons and the quantity of fissile material that the North Koreans have. Some limits have been placed on their missile ranges, and essentially both the region and the United States are at less of a risk than they are today. And in particular, that in the event that the regime collapses or there is some kind of conflict on the Korean Peninsula, there is less destructive material than there would be right now. So I think we can be skeptical about the likelihood that North Korea is going to abandon its inclination towards coercion and its inherent desire to survive, and still believe that some kind of progress may be possible.
So nobody would have predicted the last 4 months since the pre-Olympic till now. So I'm hesitant to ask you guys to close with what you're looking for over the next 4 months. But what are you looking for over the next 4 months?
Put us on the spot. Actually, what I have to say follows very closely on Mira, and it doesn't offer a more hopeful outcome. Let me first say that the chances of getting a full denuclearization agreement, to me, are well below 50%, well below 30%, if you want to put a metric on it. I don't think anyone has high confidence that we're going to move into something that even looks as good as Iran. So we're talking about slim possibilities. But here's the way I would take up your extortion question, which I think is a good question. Of course, this is extortion. What do we think a negotiation is? He's going to bring everything he can to the table, and he's going to try to get as much for it as he can. That's what we're going to be engaged in. We're going to have to pay to get this program wound down. We can't do it simply through coercion. The question is, how much can we buy? You know, that's really the question. And whether this last Central Committee meeting marks a big strategic shift where he's made the decision that he's going to look for assurances on the security front and go in an economic direction.
Well, so
that's a possibility. Okay, I can't rule it out.
Break there and tell us about this last Central Committee meeting.
Well, on April 20th, 21st, there was a plenum of the Central Committee, and he's been trying to build the party back up, by the way, as a locus of authority, chipping away at the military as the sort of center of the regime. And he's talked about the fact that now that they have a nuclear program, they don't need to pursue this anymore. They don't need to be engaged in testing. And it's time to focus the attention of the regime on economic reconstruction and development. And if that's the big shift that Mira is talking about, and which she's appropriately skeptical about, whether that shift is there. But I don't think we can rule out that it's there. You could imagine this regime pivoting and doing what China did, essentially, stabilizing the external environment and pursuing economic growth and staying in power, which obviously is, as everyone points out, is the ultimate objective of the regime. And the growth potential of North Korea All you have to do is look at its neighbors. There's no question that this country could grow at 6, 7, 8, 10% over some pretty prolonged period if it had support from the international community, if it opened up, if it reoriented, if it got a peace dividend from gradually winding down the military, if you took these men out of uniform and put them into factories. We can tell a lot of stories where this is not an implausible outcome for him to do. But we don't know until we sit down and start to negotiate how much confidence he has in the ability to turn in that direction. That's an extraordinarily difficult task. Typically, as in China, it's happened when the underlying coalition shifts. Mao dies, the Gang of Four is marginalized, Deng Xiaoping comes in. So that this would happen within the context of the Kim regime, again, I don't think it's a high probability event. But I don't see any reason not to probe it.
Mira, next 4 months, what are you looking for?
Well, just because I can't resist, I do want to add the fact that although Steph is absolutely right to point to the economic message coming out of the Central Committee meeting, it's worth noting that there were also some choice quotes on North Korea's nuclear weapons
program. Yeah, like we still have them.
Kim describing the nuclear force as a miraculous victory and a treasured sword. Which does not sound to me like a man who's preparing to part with his full nuclear arsenal. So I think we can both believe in a shift towards a new economic approach and the fact that Kim Jong-un appears to think that nuclear weapons are still essential to North Korean survival and quite an achievement of his first several years in power. From the next 4 months perspective, obviously, number one, obviously I'm looking for the summit to happen. I do believe it will happen. I would like to see a fairly detailed agreement come out of it, something that looks a lot less like the Panmunjom declaration between the North-South summit, which was high on symbolism and aspiration and incredibly low on actual substance. I'd like to see these two leaders have some evidence of a personal relationship. Because I think, as preposterous as it is, the world is safer if Trump feels like he can find a way to get along with this guy and he's not as interested in tacking back towards war. And then I would like to see in the next 4 months real movement towards talks starting at lower levels with urgency attached to them. I'd like to have an idea of what those look like by the end of the summer, who's conducting them. I'd like to see folks in place in key positions where we don't have them in place right now, an ambassador to South Korea, perhaps another special envoy who would certainly be necessary to conducting rigorous diplomacy on an ongoing basis. So I want to see the infrastructure in place on the American side that suggests that this is going to be supported along a rapid timeline and in a rigorous
way. Yeah, that's a really good point about the process, Mira.
We're going to leave it there. Steph Haggard, Mira Raphooper, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare Podcast, all 307 episodes of it, were produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. I know that some of you have still never tweeted about the Lawfare Podcast, have never shared an episode on Facebook with like a comment like, OMG, this is the greatest podcast ever, or put it on Pinterest. And if all of you go to the Apple Podcasts store and give us a rating and a review, many, many new people will learn about the Lawfare Podcast. One of those people will not be Sophia Yan, who has long been the source of our music, which she performs. And as ever, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.